entrevista con Enrique Espinosa el 15 de julio de 2016 en su residencia. Vamos a empezar.
No lo quiero hacer en inglés porque parece que es más fácil.
Interview with Enrique Espinosa, July 15 of 2016 in his home, Miami, Florida.
Enrique, where were you born, when were you born, and what were your parents, what did your parents do in Cuba?
My parents are school teachers. I was born April 27, 1949 in Havana. Most of my family comes from Havana, Puerto Rico.
And so both your parents were educators, and...
And so was my grandmother and three aunts. Almost everybody in my family was my parents.
Or Marshall Moreno. Okay, and so were they involved in politics in Cuba, or...?
My father had been involved in the fight against Machado. But after that, he was very seldom involved in any political thing. He never got involved in the anti-Batista struggle, and I once asked him why, and he said because there was no side worth dying for. No. So, and he knew Fidel from Fidel's university days when my father had been a school inspector. Mm-hmm. And he didn't trust Fidel. And he thought Batista had screwed up his legacy, which had been good in 1933 and the 1940s, and he always thought, the coup d'etat had been, the mistake that destroyed his legacy.
And so, when did your family leave Cuba? Did he
know
the reason for
that? After Fidel takes over, my father became involved with the Imperial November movement.
The anti-Castro movement.
Right, and he was in supply, and he was moving weapons. He was taking weapons and supplies from Pena del Rio to the guerrillas in Pena del Rio.
From Havana.
From Havana.
The guerrillas in Sierra Osorna.
Yeah, Sierra Osorna.
Okay.
He was also, during the Bay of Pigs, he was supposed to be parked. There were 15 or 16 police stations in Havana, and they were all to come under attack when the order came in from the CIA in the United States. And he was part of one of the groups that was going to hit one of the police stations. So on the day of the bombing of Bay of Pigs, when the planes flew over my house, one of them on fire, that morning my father said goodbye to me, and he left the house with an M1 carbine and three bombs.
That was April 15, 1961.
And I didn't see him for 3 days. But I didn't get arrested.
So
I had a cousin, one of my father's cousins was a member of Brigade 2506. And on the other side of my family, Diogles de Rapa,
the
Castro. Yeah, was the head of the Cuban Air Force for a while, the Pueblo Campano and the Castro Cuban.
Yep. And so when did your family leave for exile?
After the Bay of Pigs, my mother had been working with the MRR, and my father was 30th of November, and after the Bay of Pigs, they both decided that the situation was eventually going to, they were both going to wind up in jail, and I was going to wind up with my sister, being handed to a Cuban orphanage.
Sent to Moscow.
Yeah, sent to Czechoslovakia or something like that, or Poland. And so they decided to leave. We left November the 8th, 1961, I went to Miami. I was 12 years old.
You were on November 8th, 61.
Yeah.
And so how long did your family stay here before you moved north?
My father was a professor of Havana Military Academy and a school teacher. Started driving the vegetable truck. And my mother went to work as a cashier in a supermarket. And then in the winter of 1963, through the Ford Foundation and the state of Indiana, who needed Spanish teachers, they got an offer to revalidate their degree. They would have to spend a year under a scholarship there. So they, along with about 40 other Cuban former teachers or lawyers, revalidated their degrees, you know, with a dictionary in one hand and the books in front. But they all made out of it. So they became teachers in Indiana, and that's where I grew up.
Spanish teachers?
They became Spanish teachers.
Yeah. My mother did the same thing.
Yeah.
And so where did you grow up in Indiana?
In the Hammond-Whiting area, which is the very, very tip of northwest Indiana, near downtown Chicago.
Okay. Hammond what?
Near downtown Chicago.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it was like, you know, it was Indiana, but I could really walk, you know, a mile from my house and be on the Illinois side of the border.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
the Calumet region.
So then you went to Purdue University.
Yeah.
And you studied journalism there.
I went to different majors like everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But I finally graduated with a degree in humanities, emphasis in social studies and military science.
And what year was that?
I left college with only 3 credits left, and I finished them when I was living in New Jersey in 73. And so I graduated in absentia in 73, I guess.
So when did you go in Havana?
I have been with different Cuban movements. I was one of the organizers of PEC, the Cuban Student Federation, which I have been to for one.
Up in Chicago.
Up in Chicago.
Yeah.
And then for you, because, you know, when I started college, I realized that there were Cuban clubs in different universities. There were quite a few Cubans, so I started getting busy in the Midwest. And the Cuban Student Federation pleased me to a degree, and then it didn't please me to another degree because some of them were basically just social clubs. Mm-hmm. Others were a little more politically oriented, you know. But at the time I was hungry to seek, a struggle that I would be willing to give my life for.
Mm-hmm. And so, how did you get involved with Havana?
At the time, I was with Alpha 66 in Chicago, with a good friend, Cesar Sanchez, who later would join me in Havana, became my best friend ever. And now, we got a call from Tony Garcia and Canita Garcia, and Canita had been, I had known her from the time when my parents did the studies in Carajote. Her parents had done the studies in Carajote too. And she was studying at Champaign-Urbana, the University of Illinois. And the Vince Ramos Brigade was having a Cuba week. And they had, maybe 2 dozen Cuban students that were motivated to do something, you know, to counteract. So they contacted me and they published stuff in the Miami newspapers, and I answered and I thought I answered. So I went down to Champaign-Urbana with a car full of leaflets and fact sheets and a few so they could do some debates and everything. And Abdala sent Pedro Solari, who had just turned a bar, and they sent him with enough money to get there and not come back.
From where?
From New York.
Oh, from
New York to Champaign, Illinois. They said, he is a one-way ticket. This is the time to prove yourself. So,
what? A bus ticket? Plane ticket?
No, it was an airplane ticket. Yeah. Yeah, they got there and so we planned it together and we had...
What year was that?
That was in, very beginning of 71.
Okay.
Like maybe January of 71.
Okay.
Yeah, it was January of February, early February of 71. And what happened was, Pedrito was like this Joan Abdala, had been involved with the DRE in Cuba when he was a very young teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And we could set up a Pedrito Granado.
San Marcos Group,
Antonio
Revolucionario.
Yeah, Pedrito Granado told me, you know, he says, I couldn't have done it because they're pretty radical.
Because?
They're pretty radical.
All the time.
You know, they're, mm-hmm. they're gone hold, you see. And we're planning this great thing, and I've been asked that any of you want to go are invited to participate in this super demonstration. We're going to have a big impact. March of 1971. Which was like a few weeks away. And I said, okay, what the hell, you know? So, Tony Garcia, George Jorge Giroux, and Master Frios.
Jorge who?
Giroux.
Jorge Giroux?
He's now a doctor in Tampa. A heart special for children. But Jorge, Tony, and I went to Frios. And that was the day that 16 of our members went into the UN Security Council and chained themselves to the furniture. Now, this was the age of the protests throughout America. You know, they had taken over the university. Nobody had ever thought of taking over the UN. I mean, just...
And the Security Council.
Yeah, well, it was the UN building. Right? So, and that's what happened. We took over the building. Because what happened was, when these 16 people went in, and at the time, you know, you could have walked in probably with a bazooka, and they wouldn't know what that meant. They didn't have surveillance of any kind, you know, with these security guards. So at the time they walked in with 16 pairs of handcuffs, and they handcuffed themselves, a dilemma presented itself to the security people of the UN. The New York police doesn't have jurisdiction there. So I didn't know what to do. And they were like, we had arrived, I was across the street with maybe 40 others. And they probably thought, well, these 40 others come in here. So they shut down the building. And that was the first time in the history of the UN that the UN was shut down during a working day. It hit the front page of the New York Times with photographs. It hit almost every newspaper there was. And then Abdallah began receiving phone calls and mail from every corner that we could think of. There were people who had read the news, and they were looking for us. So I went to, on Christmas break, I flew out to Puerto Rico with Jorge Sosa, Gustavo Marin, and Enrique Macera, and we organized Abdallah in Puerto Rico through one of my best contacts, Juanita Bianchi, who was the cousin Jose Antonio Cheverria. I organized chapters in Michigan State, Purdue, University of Chicago, even high school. And I wound up having like 26 members in my Chicago chapter. So we grew, like Abdallah grew by, with that thing, Abdallah grew right. Triple or quadruple its size in a matter of months. By the end of 1971, we had, instead of just being, you know, a few people in New Jersey and a few people in New York, there was like big delegations in New York and New Jersey, and delegations spread out in Puerto Rico, in New Orleans, in Miami. Came through there.
To Puerto Rico?
Yeah. Coronel Octavio Perez came through there too. The guy who's a retired colonel?
Yeah.
He was on here. So, and that's how Abdallah got formed. Now, we had the first Congress, that's where I first met my future wife. And in the second Congress, we opened up Beyond Students. And by then we were looking to really see what, you know, we could do. We had made a name for ourselves. In 1971, the victim was getting arrested and demonstration. It was like, you know, which chapter could outdo the other one? So, you know, we had like, I think it was 50 or 60 arrests for different reasons.
Yeah.
I got arrested in Chicago. We did a demonstration on July the 7th, 72. helps anyone.
We did the demonstration at Sigmund Gower, which is Eleanor. And curiously enough, I told my people, I said, you know, if we get beat up by the cops, take it. Okay, you don't want to strike a cop, and this is Chicago cops. You know, the 1968 Democratic Convention was still fresh in a lot of people's minds.
Stage of rage.
So, when the batting wagon gets there, and they cut off our handcuffs, two black cops come up, and they handcuff me, and they handcuff everybody else. So, we walk to the paddy wagon. Now, before I get into the paddy wagon, the cop unlocks my handcuffs. He said, he does that to all of us. Now, we get in the car, he goes, man, you guys did good. He said, that's the way we did it, was summer. And he starts giving us his big speech. We're like, cool. We looked out. We get to the Cook County Jail, you know, and yeah, the Cook County Jail is, you know, when you got a guy in your, you know, your belt and the cigarette, the cop goes, not in here for everything, these guys are going to hang themselves, I'm going to put them in a cell by themselves. So I got, good, I can smoke in the cell. So we get to the cell, he says, the cop says, okay, you'll be fine over here. He says, look, he says, the food here is shit. The food here is like a bologna sandwich with no mayonnaise. You know, he says, you give me $20, I'll bring you a bag of couple of pizzas and soda, and I'll give you back the change. I'm not interested in anything. We'll have to get. So it's like, yeah, we gave him the money. We got from the bank, gives us a change, gives us pizzas, and a couple of bits and pages of soda. Now, the smell of the pizza is traveling down the hall, you know, and the regular person said, going like, the fuck, man? I'm supposed to put the pizza here, you know. No, I ain't gonna eat this shit. I want whatever those guys down the hall are doing. And the cop comes back, he says, the night call will start soon, but you guys want to see yourself in the news? Oh, yeah. He's right on the TV. He said, and plugged it right outside of his head. Yeah, so that was like my political prisoner moment.
And who was with you?
Ramon Cala, who had escaped from a prison in Cuba and became years later the head of officers in the military, and he fought in Nicaragua. Ezequiel Ignacio Álvarez Sosa came, a very good,
Ramon
Cala
was
on
that.
Yeah, he was involved. He had like double membership. Yeah. That was like seven of us.
Okay.
I can give you the names if you want, but I don't think that's a good question.
Yeah. Well, no, it should be in the Atlanta newspaper.
Yeah.
So, but you had, I recall you writing in the Atlanta newspaper and that you had, I forget what your title was, Secretary of
Trump. Well, I was the editor of the Abdallah newspaper for a while. Then I was the head of all the propaganda for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Then after we broke up with the FLNC and we rearranged things, I became the head of Section Cuba, which I held for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, but then I noticed that you were not writing in Abdallah for a while.
Yeah, but when I was editor sometimes, you know, I would write up half of the newspaper because, you know, the guys were sending in a sign or, you know, you said something was updated by now. You know.
So when was it that they formed the alliance of Abdallah
and Frente? Abdallah and Frente. The year that I got married? 72?
73, October
20th. Okay, so
I was born 1 year later.
In the summer of 73, three or four of Dada leadership met with a group of former CIA, Brigade 2506 people, and the Golden Hawks.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where base and Alpha, who was in Alpha, and basically around the beach. No nudity was involved then. No, because that's a new beach now. But and that's where it was created, and they weren't operational within by October. By October 73, they were carrying out the first operation. Now, not everybody in Abdallah became a member of the FNC. We wanted to maintain our status, and we realized that when we started bragging, we were going to get cooked. Faster than we were going to get cooked anyway. So, and it was a matter of trust. Well, years later, an FBI agent told me that Abdallah could not be infiltrated by the Castro or by them when they tried, because the way we had organized, there were so many of us who were like childhood friends, went to the same school, relatives, there were people there, we had three cousins in Abdallah. People have been together in the army. It was very family knit, go through society. And if you were like an outsider and wanted to join Abdallah, you came in and you said, yeah, I was like Special Forces Vietnam. They go, okay, no problem. And you'd be distributing newspapers, selling raffle tickets, and attending history classes, and, cleaning up the bar when we had a social event, that kind of thing. But you were not going to get into the advising group until you have been checked out and you have proved yourself.
So coming in of Abdallah, you said not only got into the frente, but how many got into the frente?
Yeah. Rubén was in the frente. I was in the frente. Fermose was in the frente. Gustavo.
De Riota,
César Sánchez.
And they were part of the trenches.
Yeah, we still maintain our Abdallah coverage, but we were, double boom, double boom.
Yeah. And so.
And then that was up there, but down here, down by Mano de Aña, Marismeña was very operational. If she had been a man, she would have had a big festival.
I know. She's gone around a lot of places.
Right. My wife was involved in the French.
Marismeña and Moon.
Pero Mama Yolene.
Yeah.
Mama Yolene. But Mara was actually infiltrated.
I basically
saw the guy's file, and he was considered by everybody, the CIA, the FBI, and some of us, to be an infiltrator. And I passed the word down the line to her. I said, break up with this guy, because, this guy, you're crazy, you're crazy, blah, blah, blah. And then maybe she said something to him, but 2-3 days later, he was gone.
Yeah. And he was involved in the tunnel in Mexico City to dig out Puerto Rico. Ramoncito was involved in it.
Yeah. Ramoncito.
I
have a photo of him there sitting in a boat. I don't make one of those deals.
this defector then is, obviously trying to infiltrate her to get information on the frame.
And I think they're trying to infiltrate that part. They were trying to just get into the inner group of the FNC.
And I killed one, I got the one, but I killed one. He was living with that part because I think he grew up from Cuba.
Yeah.
But the answer was the guy disappeared.
Went back to Cuba.
Yeah. And so, but what finally brings about the split between, why does Abdallah pull out of the fighting?
Yeah, because I think there were political factors involved. Now, I can't vouch for that because the guy, doing that shoveling back and forth between Miami and New Jersey was Lázaro Ramírez. And he was talking to Gustavo. And then when we decided to go semi-public, which was the creation of Frente Nacional, which we had Pedro Acosta, Hector Fabián, I'm talking about the political
class. Right, but she was also on that one.
She was on that one. There was Gustavo Marín, Pedro Acosta,
El Padre Humberto López.
Hector Fabián, Humberto López Padre.
Yeah.
So when that came about, I think Eagle started the clash. And I think, naturally, I think Gustavo wanted a bigger piece of the political pie as far as the power and the control, because Abdallah was putting in people, and Abdallah was putting in money, and Abdallah was doing a lot of intelligence operations everywhere, from them, including Europe. And on the other hand, they got a Caliente, who had been in the underground in Cuba when Gustavo was learning how to weapon bugs, would feel that maybe this guy is moving into my territory and he doesn't know what he's doing. And I think it was just a matter of different egos clashing and different strategies and of people thinking, I know what we should do, and what we should do is not what this guy thinks we should do. And in the middle, of course, there was a military unit. The guys who really pulled the shots, a guy like Frank Castro, who was really the guy who put it all on the line, and was really the supreme commander of the whole thing, his head was sticking way, way up, And he didn't like putting up with bullshit with political pressure. This is what we're going to do, this is what we should do, So it's always like the eternal clash that happened in the American Revolution between the Continental Congress and the Continental Army, etc. And that's what I think happened, basically. I think Latterfield stayed in Abdallah, but also kept working with the FMC after the breakup. The Wayne just left and went with the FMC.
Well,
the
only time he got kicked out of Abdallah.
Well, that was a friction with Lázaro, but the Wayne was from a beat. Okay? So, did you get fired with any quick?
I said that Gustavo sent him a letter saying, you kick out of the group and tell the friend that give us back the weapons we gave him.
Which never happened.
Yeah, of course.
But I acquired some of those weapons.
Now after the split in after the split in 1975, Gustavo begins to write to Mario Suarez and the Social Democrat parties in Europe.
Yeah.
He begins to establish contact with them. All of a sudden, you see that the line in Abdallah, they begin to call him compañero in the newspaper and compañera.
Yeah, that's when some of the friction started. basically the Abdala format, political ideology was social democrat, but that was just on paper, really. Well, many of us, I mean, I consider myself a capitalist nationalist, if anything, you know. And a lot of us were there just because of the right, okay? We thought that was the most effective way, and we were very, very effective, you know, for many, many years, the most effective way of damaging the system. The way I figure it, you know, if it's going to be a social democrat ideology, it's all going to change if we ever come to power, because they're going to realize that you can't bring in foreign investors when you're asking for half the property of funds.
Now, a lot of these social democrat parties and movements, you know, finance their followers. So some people said that there was some of that going on with the Dalai Lama.
Not to my knowledge.
That they got that. Well, all those trips that, like Tanzania was taking to Kenya and...
No, some of those trips were freebie trips where they wanted to, you know, different, you know, group views or international this and that. They pay their expenses. But basically, they weren't paying for anything else. They weren't paying for newspaper. They weren't paying for news.
Right. So who was paying for these trips abroad?
The different organizations that, the social democrat organizations that they contact.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the same way that, say, if you're a newspaper or a media person and you're sympathetic to the Jewish cause, you know, Israel sometimes, you know, invites 50 newspaper or media people to go to it because it's PR.
Yeah.
So that's what they did. For more, but as far as profitability, no, not to my knowledge. You know, and what happened was that after a couple of years, Lutau decides to go to law school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And basically, when he went to law school, he became like the Queen of England. You know, he was kind of symbolic, but the organization was being run by Cesar Sanchez, by myself, by Jose Torrens, you know. And we were then basically doing, you know, whatever we wanted as far as, you know, we did make a lot of contacts in Cuba, we did establish some resistance things in Cuba, we did carry out some minor sabotages in Cuba. And then, you know, there comes a series of events when people just, you know, grew more and more frustrated with, and I think Gustavo released his own propaganda. No, seriously, I think he believed that he was like, let me tell you, the guy had potential. He could speak well, he could be mesmerizing at the, you know, at the barricade language. He was a pretty good analyst when he didn't, of political events, when he didn't let his prejudices get in the way of his analysis. But on the other hand, he had the ego, and when, you know, when you try to surround yourself by yes men, you know, you begin to feel that you're infallible. So anybody who votes against you is not a good guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so after I left Abdala, about 64 people left Abdala within a matter of months. And that was like basically the end of the organization. Yeah, I mean, it stumbled on for 3 years, but that was it.
In the our Senate column, it came out that some of Gala members got involved as bodyguards for that Fernandez drug dealer.
Yeah, that was an exaggerated statement.
Yeah?
Okay. Manny Fernandez, the drug dealer, had been a machete.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sympathetic to any human cause. And he did give Abdala some money, but it was no strings attached.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he didn't expect us to be gun runners for him. He didn't expect us to, you know, run drugs for him or to do the bus. He just said, here, you know, I got plenty of money here. Use this any way you want, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
At that time we were seeing him because, you know, he represented a source of financing that was no strings attached.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no real. I knew Manny Fernandez. You know, he had an insurance company, and as a matter of fact, for a while, he gave employment to Taylor Hammond.
Mm-hmm.
let's say your Ramos arrived from Puerto Rico to New Jersey and you get a job with us and you put him to work in the insurance company. Now, say it wasn't drug dealing, you were working in the insurance company. Guy.
Well, this is a man from Memphis that was involved with Alcana.
Yeah.
Alcana was collecting his cash.
Yeah, that was, yeah. That, but that was years ago.
Yeah.
In the 80s, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, whenever anybody entered Abdallah, we tried to check him out to, you know, the neighbors, the people who knew him. If he came from a certain section of, you know, people like Belgrado or Santa Maria, we try to contact people from that town, find out whether he came from a communist family, whether, you know, he had been had political prison, who was recommending him to bring him. And then, when I took over Section Q, one of the things I did was give out different data or information to different people. Like if somebody was asking questions, well, how are we doing this? And I said, yeah, we're doing pretty good. We just got 10 pounds of explosives. The next person I would say was 11 pounds. Another guy, 8 pounds. So the FBI came around questioning anybody. And sometimes they threw things to shock you. You know, and FBI agent said, you know, now I know you guys, you know, just got all the big pounds of explosives. I could track it back to who it was. We never use our phones for anything sensitive. For a while I had, which was confiscated by the FBI, I had one of those telephone flip phones that I could, you know, the ones that telephone people use to check.
Yeah,
check on. I could walk, you know, into any building in the university, go and boom, hook up at night, and call somebody at a public phone.
I
don't know.
I used to call all
this into
one of
those. I did too. And that's how I got, that one was confiscated by the FBI when they searched.
There was a lion's phone, and it had two little alligator clips on. You could walk on any
Line or box, just took it in.
Money
to
have
much. Okay, money to have much.
When did he get into
Abdallah? When did he join Abdallah in Chicago? He joined Abdallah in Chicago in one chapter. He was like, I had maybe 7 or 8 members at the time. And he lived upstairs in Hospital 66 in the same building. And he was married and he had a little kid. And he was at the time a student at, I think it was Roosevelt University in Chicago.
And he lived in the apartment above Alpha 66 headquarters?
Yeah, he could have been monitoring. Yeah. But then he became a pretty good member of Abdallah, and he was very active. But one thing happened one night. We were driving in Chicago, him and I. And we're discussing different bullshit. A couple of guys in another car, you know, got in front of us, and then, you know, one of these road race things started. So he whips out a weapon and waves it at the guy. And the guy peels off and leaves us. So 3 or 4 blocks down, and here comes a Chicago police car. They stop us, and they said, "You have a weapon?" He goes, "Yeah." You know? So we were arrested. When we were on our way to jail, he said, "Don't worry about a thing." After like, he said, "Don't say anything, don't worry about it, you know, and don't worry about a thing," which was okay. I wasn't going to say anything to anybody. You know, I wasn't being judged, he didn't have the weapon on me. But they were keeping me around, so. 2 hours later, a fed shows up. You know, and we go out the door.
What year was this?
This was before, this was in 71.
71,
okay. This was shortly after he had joined the club. This was before, sometime in the summer of 71. When he comes out, he gives me this, because the guy was very good. He was as good as Mono Morales, as immoral as Mono Morales. He would come up with a story in a quarter of a second, you know. No, absolutely. And he would tell you so convincingly that if you gave him a lie detector test, he'd pass. So, because he believed it, you know?
So he comes out and he goes, this is a bed I've been helping because my uncle is an agent with the something or other investigation of the federal, blah, 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 man from uncle kind of thing. And I'm helping him on a drug deal, you know, at the university. And I looked at him and I thought, okay, you gotta shut that, you know, from now on I can't trust the next level. So a few months later, all of a sudden he calls me and he says, I'm leaving Abdala and you'll find out why in the next 24 hours. Okay? And that night they arrested 26 different people in Chicago, which were part of a drug network ring that Manolo claimed they were bringing in diplomatic pouches to Europe. And then he disappeared because he was the main witness in discovery. Now, jump ahead a couple of years, and now I'm in New Jersey, and I'm in the FMNC, and I'm doing mostly supply stuff, buying weapons, moving weapons, doing intelligence operations, taking photographs, all the kind of basic intelligence stuff. I get a call. Inga, how are you? You're out of the book. I'm fine. Listen, I'm up in upstate New York, but I got a deal. We can really pull something off. I meet you in Albany, which is halfway. And I said, okay, Albany. He says, you pick a place. I said, I don't know Albany, but Albany's got a post office, right? And the central post office in Albany. 10:30 in the morning. I went along, I told the, Jose Jolene and Cesar, and I popped a pistol and a knife holster, and I went along. He picks me up in a Jag, in a Jaguar. And he says, sorry I haven't seen you in a while, but I had to get out of Chicago with that deal. He says, I'm really working for the CIA. I said, yes, okay, right. So he takes out, he says, look here, and he shows me several envelopes that full staff sets up to this agency, He says, I can't show you what's inside. Yeah, okay. You can have those printed too, So he says, listen, the word is down the grapevine that you guys have been working with the FMC, that you guys are involved in all these, he says, you guys are doing great. Because, at the time we had, awesome embassies and we had done two or three commando hits into Cuba, into the coast of Cuba. And he says, I got information on the Cuban embassy in Montreal. He says, and they don't have to suspect me because I'm working for the federal government, but we can pull this together. So I said, that sounds like a good idea. I went back, I sat down with the top brass, and I told him, I said, this is obviously in the trap. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to come up with a plan, and when they do a false arrest on me, we'll blow it out of proportion. They were trying to entrap men, and they knew they were being entrapped, and blah, 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 and it would be good headlines. Okay. So we start conversations back and forth. Oh, this line is secure. Of course, talking to you, the secure CIA line. Bullshit, I know you're taking me. So I said, no, we gotta see each other again. So the next time, I drove with Eduardo Lima, and I drove up to Syracuse. And we met with him at his apartment in Syracuse. And at the time, I told him, I said, this is what we're gonna do. We're gonna use the July the 4th weekend, which is a holiday, and a lot of boats are cruising back and forth between the U.S. and Canada. And we're going to rent the boat and go across this fishing net. And I'm going to bring C4 hidden inside a beer can kind of operation. So in my mind, my C4 was going to be Play-Doh. I was going to pack Play-Doh, white Play-Doh into this container, put it in a cooler, and they arrested me and charged me, It was, I was in Akron. I was looking forward to it, actually. But he is barren. No, it was the 4th of July. No, it was the 26th of July. It was the 26th of July, right?
Right here.
So what happened was the FBI got apparently that here I was handling explosives, and tomorrow morning I was going to leave for Canada. Why did they mean they could intercept me in the border or something?
What year was that?
71. No, 71. Eric hasn't been born yet. You were pregnant.
I was pregnant.
Yeah, 74. Okay. So, all of a sudden, we're getting ready to go out to dinner. She's pregnant with Eric. And the doorbell. She had been mugged the day before. That had nothing to do with, but, you know, when I saw a police car, I figured, well, you know, they use police and FBI. Maybe they're surrendered. But when I walked down the stairs, I had just popped my Walter PPK into an ankle holster. And I don't think the tape recorder can pick you up over here. But they still have the bell-bottom pants, and I popped my ankle holster with a Walter PPK. I opened the door, and there's like 11 of them. A couple of them were FBI, a couple of them were police. Search warrant for the house. Okay. They started searching the house. I wasn't worried. You know. The guy said, do you have any weapons? No, I wasn't going to tell him because I had my ankle, but I said, yeah, I have a revolver here. So he says, where is it? I said, in that closet. Now, I had a .22 revolver, which had the trigger and the butt rolled with electrical tape, so there wouldn't be any fingerprints left on the weapon. And there was my phone equipment. So they take that. I had access to it. We're going to take you down for interrogation. Can you come with us? Oh, yeah. Can I put on a jacket? I never put on jackets. I'm like a t-shirt, shirt, you know, jeans kind of guy. You know, which my wife gave me a look like. And as I went into the closet and picked up the jacket, I went into my ankle and I threw the pistol in the closet. So I had an empty ankle. So they take me to the Elizabeth Police Station, the FBI. And they had an interrogation. They said, you want me to take me away to Newark? And they had an interrogation team there. And they started with, you know, what are you doing with this? Well, I don't know, I've had it for a long time. Who gave it to you? And I think I mentioned a tutor to the EFB, who had already been killed. You know, the guy says, a tutor to the EFB. That name was since about, yeah, he was shot like a few weeks ago.
That was April. No, 74.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and this was July. Mm-hmm. So I said, yeah, you shot a few weeks. Anytime anybody dies, you blame everything on him, you know?
Yeah.
So I said, yeah, and I threw it over the view. He says, do you know where Orlando Bush is? I said, I don't even know Orlando Bush in person. He says, well, you know who he is, and you've worked with all his people, and yeah. I said, I don't know where he is. I said, what would you be, you know? I said, maybe Texas. And the guy says, why Texas? I said, I don't know, I like horseback riding. And it went like back and forth like this. And I said, well, okay, be careful, you know. We know things. And I said, you know, if you know things, why don't can you come charge me? No. I said, then you don't know things, you suppose things, right? So, bye. So I went back to the house. Put my gun back in my ankle holster. And we said, let's go to dinner with Enrique Macera and his wife. When we get into the car, we realize Macera says, this is a car following us. I mean, they were like right there behind us. So I was driving that night, wasn't it? Yeah, I was driving. They were in our car. So, No, yeah, because I ran all those lights. I started timing the lights, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I started timing the lights, I don't know, 23, 24, 25, 26 now. So I was hitting every light on yellow, and they were following me. They would have to stop, and they were running lights. So we get all the way to the north side of New York. And boy, they're clinging to me, these two guys. At the time, I parked the car, we went to dinner to the house of this Cuban doctor. He was a medical student, he was finishing his medicine, now a very well-known doctor in Miami. And as I begin to walk, my weapons start sliding down my ankle. So in the middle of the street, I said, I can't help him. And I bent over, the FBI agent was walking, I'd gotten off the car and he was walking across the street from me. And I bent over and I fixed my weapon and I did it real slow because he froze the moment he saw it, he realized what I was doing. So, and my wife had brought anything that was confidential that was left in the apartment. They had, except for one thing, they had missed. When we did the commando raid on October the 3rd, 73, one of the trophies to prove that we had been there was the big Soviet clock that was hanging on the boat. And that was hidden deep in my closet in a bag. And a City of Elizabeth policeman picked it up and he said, what's this? This is not American. My wife said something like, oh, I don't know, it's been there for a long time, kind of thing. So he put it back in. That was the only proof, you know, that would have had that I would have linked me with the FNC. But we had leaflets and other things that were very well hidden.
They went into the Holy Cross and they took two shopping bags that I had. We took a car from our wedding. We just got married, what, 7 months prior to that. Because they were looking. We think that someone had been inside the house before. Because in my closet, in my bedroom, we had two shopping bags full of the
stencils
and a lot of compromising stuff that only we had gone and we were part of it we had. So they had an extension, but they sent me from the city of Miami of Elizabeth. So they took the two shopping bags.
So as we walk into this doctor's apartment, I said to him, the FBI was just searching me. I want to leave these pencils here with you. I said, I want to leave the weapon too, because now they realize that I'm armed, they might stop me again. So he says, fine. He says, I got a perfect place for the weapon. So he takes from the couch, the cojín of the couch,
yeah.
You know, and he unzips it, opens up a little slit there, and puts the gun in there, closes it up, puts it back, he says, there, he says, nobody will find it, and then his little girl comes up and goes, Bobby, boom, 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 you know, points, but he goes, okay, he says, my uncle's on vacation in Europe, he lives too far up. He says, I'll take it up there. And for the next 3 days or 4 days, we were like under 24-hour surveillance.
And this is as a result of what?
My wife only asked this squeal. He didn't call me. But for the next 3 or 4 days, we were, myself, Lazaro Ambare, a couple others were under 24-hour surveillance time. I took a little sense of humor. I mean, I come out of the car, I come out of the house, and I walk over to the car, and I go, okay, guys, just in case you lose me, I'm going down to the bakery, such and such a place. From there, I'm going to such and such a place. And one guy told me, he says, can't you go on vacation? One of the other guys is going on vacation. Last time I decided he was going to go to, like, you know, some beach. Cape Cod. So the agents had to follow him and, you know, to Cape Cod. I said, no, I said, I'm going to go around the house here. I went out bike riding, and I would bike ride with a car trailing me at 20 miles an hour, no matter where I went. When Lázaro came over the dog, we were walking around the block, walking like this, you know, with our hands like this so you couldn't lip read. And there were two cars following us, with four agents. The outstanding moment came when I had already figured out, in the city, all the places I could lose anybody, escape from anybody, or hide from anybody, you know, within 1 square mile of my house. So what I did was, there was a young guy driving that day, and an old guy that I later met, when I was doing car rescue. But I went out and I said, hey guys, I'm going to go listen. And the young guy, obviously out of point, he gave me like one of his dirty looks, like, you criminal.
But his girl saw him, was he up in New Jersey?
Yeah, he was up in New Jersey, but he doesn't play that part of the story. I haven't met him yet. So I tell these guys, I'm going to go this way and I'm going to do this and that. So after I went to the bakery or something with my wife, I'm driving down East Jersey, which is a very busy street in Elizabeth that crosses US 1, which is dynamite traffic, right? So what I did was I timed the lights perfectly. As it went from yellow to red, I ran the light at US 1, and they couldn't just go through that because the traffic was immense. I stepped on the gas and I went up like a block and a half real quick, and there was a bank there that was closed on a Saturday. And I went around the back of the bank and I went and hid behind the building that faced the street. So what I could, basically if I looked at an angle, I could see the cars come flashing by.
So did you ever confront my one day Amazon?
Yeah. Well, that's the long story. He came back and back and over and over.
Well, what did he say when he called him?
Well, the FBI guy car comes over. And now I went and followed them for like 2 blocks.
Mm-hmm.
He took the horn. And the old guy was cracking up. The young guy was pissed off. I don't hear from Manuel de Amos for months. Mm-hmm. You know? Then I'm sending the telegram, he's in Cuba. The telegram said, listen to the radio show today.
That was April 76th that he showed up in Cuba.
Now, when he goes into the radio in Cuba and TV, he claims that I killed the Lázaro and I killed Rolando Mafrefet. Donna had been involved. You can get the whole statement that he made.
Yeah, I was on both.
From there, he supposedly goes to London to work with who was the CIA rogue agent. He supposedly, from there, he screws them over.
No, he was trying to get into, there was another guy that had written a book exposing the CIA that wasn't the guy that ended up in Iran or his dad.
No, this guy was in London.
Yeah, right. But it was a guy who wrote a book. No. It was
he died already.
It was a guy that wrote a book. I have a book. Big book where he denounced all the CIA covert agents in Europe.
Yeah.
Wolf. The last name was Wolf. He was supposed to infiltrate, and through him, he went to join this guy to get to the guy who went to Cuba, the CIA,
the CIA defector there. Was it Pelican? The American guy. What's his name? That wrote the book.
Anyway,
I'm sure you can straighten it up.
No.
Anyway, he comes back to the United States. Now he's claiming. Yeah, all of a sudden he comes back Sunday. Pick it. I haven't seen him in years. The last time he was accusing me of being a murderer. Now let's get together. I'm back in America. I said, are you for real? Yeah.
And where was he at when he called you?
In New York.
In New York?
So he said, let's get together. So
because
I get together. And you know, we sit at a restaurant, I'm armed and I want to use the weapon to a degree. And he says, I said to him, I said, you know, you really threw me under the train. He says, no, man, I think you're famous. He said, they couldn't prove any of the things I said. And I knew that, so I made you famous. And it opened the door because I was in a CIA operation, and then they sent me to London on the CIA operation. He says, now I'm back here. And
so he told you that he went to London.
Yes.
But from London he went to Havana. Still a baby.
He paid me to write a ghost write a book for him.
Okay, Philip A. Do you have my, we go on my website for my books, look up intelligence books.
Okay, I have
to look up your book. Okay, last one. Look up W-O-L-F-E, look it up, and then just put W-O-F-L-E, Amazon, and then put... The CIA was trying to reach Phil Agee, and they were going to use the clown to get to him. And, but they first sent him to London, to talk to, no, are you on page 10? Are you in the intelligence section? Yeah, look up. Louis Wolf. And what's the title of the book?
Very Worth, the CIA Western Europe.
Very Worth, the CIA Western Europe. They sent him to go see this guy in London. He had just published his book, Wolf, with the hope that Wolf would open the door for him to fill him. And it didn't work out. And so when he couldn't, approach AG, because AG was hiding in Europe and couldn't get to him, that's when he went back to Chicago. And in Chicago, in 1977, he was working for the sheriff's office as a, he was working in the courthouse as, a guy that, against people that have outstanding warrants.
Crazy.
After he's on four Cook County Sheriff's
Office. Well, then, that part I didn't know. Yeah. Because I didn't see him for several years. Yeah. Then all of a sudden, he's back in Miami in the 90s. Mm-hmm. He calls me up, he says, man, he says, I'm doing great. He says, come and see me in Coral Gables. He had an office in Coral Gables, a half a floor. And he said, I'm married this girl, pretty girl. And he says, I'm married, this is my second wife, so and so, and he says, we have a number of perfume boutiques and airports throughout the world. Yeah, which apparently he did, you know, because he was loaded, right? And he had like a yacht, and he had, it wasn't broken. It was from there, you know, he says, you know, come, you know, we'll go out boat riding. I said, we go boat riding, usually one of us would have gone back, you know, because I always treated him as that arm's length thing, you know, I was buddy-buddy with him, but, you know, if I was sitting in a restaurant, you know, if he would take a drink of water, if he didn't take a drink of water, didn't drink mine, you know, kind of thing. So he says, when I was in Laos or Cambodia or someplace like that, he says, I met a human ambassador and I had a big argument with him about that. And he showed me the guy's home. Then I'm here for months and months. Then all of a sudden he calls me up. He says, I'm in Spain. I want you, I says, I'm alone. He says, I want you and a couple other guys to come up here in Barcelona and hang out with me at pay reading. I said, nah, I said, I don't really want to take a vacation in Spain right now. But I said, when are you going back to the States? He said, I can't come back. I have this little problem. Okay? So, totally immoral. So in 1980 or 81, in 81, I think it was, I was already working at Montague. I come across a distinct diario, Dominican Republic, that I was looking for news for editing. The FBI...
81?
By 81, I think. Or 82? No, no, it wasn't that. It was, I had just started working there. It was 81 or 82.
Mm-hmm.
I find a distinct diario, an article saying the FBI, the Dominican government was very pissed off at the FBI because they had raided a place like Casa de Campo and taken prisoner and kidnapped Manolo de Armas, his wife, and a couple of European cronies. And they were accused of a $20 million fraud. I think that maybe those perfume things were maybe counterfeit perfumes would have made by the Cuban government that he was sent. That would have been very possible. But he got, and then I didn't hear from him until like a couple of years later. Can't give an exact date, but I know it was the same Daniel's birthday was in June. Because I remember I was talking about Daniel's birthday in the news came in. But I don't remember the exact year. Like a couple of years after that, he died in prison.
Okay. He wrote that book, but we assume it's against you.
No, he had me write another one, he made me catch it. In English. Rough crap there.
So the compilation is against you? Can you write it?
No, it was his uncle wrote it for him.
His uncle wrote the book for him, and that was in, I forget, the 80s or that came out?
Probably.
Yeah.
When he contacted me, he said, I wanted to do my story, I'm a business guy, so he gave me cash, you know. He never told it to me.
So he was in federal prison?
He died in federal prison.
And what cancer? Do you remember all the year?
No, but it was before 85.
Before 1985?
No, no, before 2005. I mean, you know, that's, yeah. That's where I have mine.
Before 2000?
Too many bolts to the head. 2001 was when he got kidnapped from 2002,
yeah. Okay.
And then like maybe 2004, 2005, 2003 he died in prison.
Okay. So by 2001 he got kidnapped out of the Dominican Republic.
Yeah.
Okay.
But Manolo Yama was totally immoral.
Yeah. And then you heard he died in federal prison?
Yeah, no, I know. I talked to his son.
Okay.
Because his son called me and, you know, his son said to me, his son is now grown. He says, I know you wrote this book for my father, but he never published it in English.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, he paid me for it, so, you know, my name is not associated. You can do whatever you want with that book.
Mm-hmm.
But he never published it.
Thank you very much.